On Sunday, November 6th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature the innovative jazz trumpeter, cornetist, flugelhornist, composer, and band leader, Woody Shaw. We'll talk to Woody's son, Woody Shaw III, and sample the box set, Woody Shaw, the Complete Columbia Albums Collection. That's Sunday, November 6th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Hey, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. My name's Joyce Jones, and coming up next, we have exactly what was mentioned on the promotion, as soon as I can get my hands on it. Yes, the name of this program is Sugar in My Bowl. My name is Joyce Jones, and our feature this evening is Woody Shaw, Woody Shaw Jr. We had a conversation with Woody Shaw III, his son, and all right, if everything is working properly, and it should be, we'll be hearing it soon. Yeah, real soon. All right, is that it? Okay, let's start right now. Okay, maybe not right now. I'm learning my way around this this relatively new CD player, and let's see, I think it's this one. My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm here with
Woody Louis Armstrong Shaw III.
Okay, how did you wind up with all of that name?
That's a very good question. Actually, you'd have to speak to my parents.
Okay, you never asked them about that.
I have actually asked them about that, and I think that around the time that I was born, my mother and my father were trying to decide if they wanted to name me after my father. But my father always had in mind to give me a middle name of one of his idols. So it was going to be either someone like Art Blakey or Dizzy, or it ended up being Louis Armstrong, obviously, because he was a trumpet player.
And who's your father?
My father is the late, great jazz trumpeter composer Woody Shaw.
We're going to start with the CD sets.
Great.
Well, I have, courtesy of you, two sets, six CD sets.
Right.
One is on your father, Woody Shaw, the Complete Columbia Albums Collection. And the other, Dexter Gordon.
Yep.
The Complete Columbia Albums Collection.
That's right.
Now, how did you wind up being involved in these box sets?
Well, that probably goes back to 1978 when I was born. You know, many people probably are unaware, but Dexter Gordon was my stepfather. And it is part of the ongoing preservation of both of their legacies to be involved in the reproduction of their music. And this particular project was initially led by producer Michael Cuscuna. And I have a pre-existing professional relationship with him from working for Mosaic Records. And he was the original producer for all of these original albums.
And he was on Blue Note.
Michael did a lot of work on Blue Note.
Okay.
A lot of many of the reissues he's responsible for.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the Sony re-releases as well. And there's a new division of Sony called Pop Market.
Mm.
It's an online-only distribution model, D2C, which is direct-to-consumer. They don't use many of the third-party distribution outlets. So that's www.popmarket.com. And they're relatively new, and they have an entire new series, which is the Complete Columbia Albums Collection, is one of the series that they have.
Oh, okay.
And Woody Shaw and Dexter Gordon are within that series. But they have many others, like Wayne Shorter, Stan Getz, Weather Report, Return
wow.
to Forever, Duke Ellington, Miles Davis, Nina Simone.
And they're all six CD.
They're as many CDs as they've done
oh.
on Sony.
Okay.
So it's their complete Sony collection.
Wow.
Like the Tony Bennett is like 30 CDs or something. Yeah, it's crazy.
Wow.
So Michael, being the expert producer and historian that he is, of course, was called upon to do these because he was the original producer. And I kind of muscled my way into it.
Like so I what said, qualified you to muscle your way into the
Well, a number of things. First of all, at this stage, being in this with these particular artists, I am the one who administers both of their legacies and former estates. So in my father in particular, there is no one else who's qualified but me. With Dexter Gordon, my mother is the one who inherited that responsibility and the one who is largely responsible for maintaining his legacy over the past 20 years. But me coming of age and taking on the responsibility, I've kind of inherited that. But on the professional level, I've also worked. We did, in 2005, the reissue of my father's Village Vanguard album, Stepping Stones, together.
Mm-hmm.
So I have some experience working with him in that environment. And he knows that I care
working
about
with Michael.
It, working with Michael.
Yeah.
And he knows that, you know, my commitment is 1,000%. I think that when we eventually finish, I think we were both glad that we worked together on this.
Well, it's a very impressive collection. I mean, aside from it being a beautiful package.
Thank you.
Both of them are very beautiful packages.
Yeah. Yeah.
And contain very important works. Very
I actually designed the boxes.
Did you now?
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. Sorry, I left that out. Yeah, that was one of the things was that it was in these situations, I think because of the nature of the music business now, departments are smaller, they're more consolidated, and mm-hmm. people are more willing to experiment and take risks and do things. So I'm a web designer and developer for about 8 years, 7 or 8 years now.
Oh, okay.
So I have some visual design experience. So we tried it, and it worked out, and we worked together.
Well, speaking of the visual design, on the Woody Shaw box set, and you talk about this in the notes, the I Ching.
Right.
And the symbols on both sides of the I Ching.
Right.
You want to explain that for the listeners?
Sure. I try not to lose our audience. But. Well, basically, what I've tried to do for years now, since I think I've consciously assumed the responsibility of maintaining my father's legacy and preserving his music, in the most honest and true form possible, is to extend his vision and his philosophy, if you will, of music and of life through whatever medium that may be. If I'm producing an event or if I'm like producing a CD or whatever it is, it could be some multimedia or digital media type of thing or working with people. I try to extend what his beliefs and artistic vision were through the work that I do. And my father was, I think, for his generation when he came up in the 60s, a lot of the musicians were really, really searching for solutions and new information. You know, there was kind of a a revolution of the mind and kind of a spiritual quest among many musicians in this, I mean, you know, in this music generally, but particularly in the 60s, 70s. And he was part of that generation, and so I think he became exposed to a lot of Eastern philosophy. He was also into Indian music and things of that nature. But with this particular cover of the complete Columbia Albums collection symbolizes some of the principles that I felt were most characteristic of his legacy and of him as a human being. And the main symbol in the center is the symbol of the yin-yang, which is the fundamental cosmological principle in ancient Chinese philosophy. And it represents balance and duality, but ultimately harmony of the two polarities, you know. And that can be a metaphor for many different things. That can be happy and sad. That can be good, bad. That can be life and death, mm-hmm. tragedy and triumph, you know, mm-hmm. all of those things. Which I think his music, as much as anyone else's, you know, of many of the great artists of his time, exhibits those extremes. But also symbolizes his search for harmony in his music, you know, and in his life. And the two characters on either side of the central symbol represent the first one, I believe is Qing. I'm probably not saying it correctly. But first one symbolizes honesty, you know, sincerity. And I think that that was one of the qualities that separated my father from many people, especially in his art. Because as much as he may have achieved some level of celebrity when he reached Columbia Records, it was the result of a lot of sacrifice and holding to his principles, you know, and that can go either way. You can do that and end up not achieving success as a result of that. And in this particular case, he was very fortunate to get the support of people like Michael Cuscuna and Bruce Lumbaugh, who believed in his vision as an artist and respected him for not, quote unquote, selling out, so to speak.
Now, Bruce Lumbaugh was the president?
He was at the time, yes, the president of Columbia Records. So as I've grown older, a man now, and I can appreciate the fact that he remains steadfast in, you know, his convictions. So that sincerity, I think, is something that was unique for him. You know, it wasn't just music was something to be, well, like a performing art or a form of entertainment. It was like his ultimate mean of expressing his vision and what was in his heart to the world. And the second symbol symbolizes, it's Xin, which is X-I-N. It means heart. So together they mean true heart, a sincere heart. And they have a certain implication that it's kind of devotional. Devote yourself to someone or something that you love or to a religious practice or something. You know, you give all of yourself to it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that my father was very unique in his relationship with music because it didn't matter what the conditions of his life circumstances were, that he gave all of himself to jazz as an art form, to advance the art form, no matter what, for better or worse. So I think that that, in some sense, is a sacrifice that a lot of the musicians from his generation made that my generation kind of rides on, you know. Mm-hmm. And a lot of us were not aware of it, you know, how much these guys, like, worked and gave themselves to the art so that the art could be of the highest standard and could be of some kind of benefit to the world, to humanity, you know, so we have something beautiful to look towards, you know. That just didn't come from practicing. That came from a lot of suffering and investment of time and soul and hard work. So I'm very cognizant of these things, you know, in this particular time in the world. So I want my father's music and the message of the music to be very clear into these changing times, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want it to just be, you know, well, Woody the trumpet player. No, I think there's a little more to it than that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So and so it has to do with just basically being true to what his beliefs were, you know.
Talking about dedication to the music, not only were you involved in the production of these CD box sets, I understand, and you have shared, that you're also involved with the Mary Lou Williams Foundation.
That's right.
Tell me about that. How did you wind up being involved with the Mary Lou Williams Foundation?
Well, it's actually similar, you know, in our community, and I say our community because among those of us that who are family and have inherited these types of responsibilities, it's a small, relatively small circle. And we do it not necessarily because that's our choice. Mm. You know, it's something that is kind of both endowed and left to us. We have a choice, of course, not to do it. So the executive director of the Mary Lou Williams Foundation was someone that was in our circle, Father Peter O'Brien. I guess at some point he had seen some of the things I was doing and, you know, reached out to me and said, you know, I kind of like how you're doing it, and I see the dedication, and I need someone who's young and is, like, really, you know, obsessed like me. Mm-hmm. And so we got involved, and we have a common mission and a common value system as far as this music is concerned, because Mary Lou Williams is one of the greatest composer, musicians, musical thinkers, and humanitarians in the history of music, mm-hmm. you know, and in jazz in particular. Mary Lou Williams was a mentor to people like Tad Dameron, Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, even Thelonious Monk and mm-hmm. Bud Powell. You know, they used to come to her and learn a lot of things about music and harmony. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but she helped a lot of people out who were facing different challenges in their lives or different things with their health. She opened a charity, I think, in the 1950s to help a lot of musicians. And she was one of the first, actually, entrepreneurs in the business, black entrepreneurs, in the sense of starting her own publishing company very early. So there are a lot of things about her that are very admirable, and, you know, we're trying to kind of make more well-known to the public. And so there's certain parallels between the work that we do, and that's how I got involved, more or less.
Now, you had a birthday on Wednesday.
Yes.
October 12th.
Right.
Happy belated birthday.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
So you celebrated, huh?
I did celebrate. I think maybe a bit too much, actually. Yeah. I feasted on a lot of good food yesterday.
That was apparently reminiscent of your grandmother's cooking?
Absolutely, it was. And in some ways, a tribute to her.
Tell me about your grandmother.
Oh, wow. That's a whole other special area. My grandmother is Rosalie Peggy Shaw. She's a matriarch, if you will, of the Shaw family. Well, my grandmother is, as far as I see it, is like the core of the Shaw family, and her influence, her love, and understanding is pervasive throughout the family, and I think it is something I know. I definitely see the influence in my father's music. Like, for example, the album Rosewood was dedicated to both of my grandparents, mm-hmm. Rosalie Shaw and Woody Shaw Sr.
Oh, okay.
And if you'll see in the booklet, there's a picture of my grandparents and my father together. So my grandmother has a very special role to me in the family. And she was also a legendary cook, you know.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, a christening party was held for me at the Village Vanguard.
Oh, really?
It was, yeah. And
not too many young people could say that.
No. You know, I think that around the time that I was born, my father's success brought a lot of joy to the jazz community, you know, and the prospect of there being some continuity and like future generations to inherit the legacy. I think that was something a lot of musicians understood. But anyway, my grandmother cooked all of the food for the christening. You know,
wow.
She garbage buckets full of like beans and potato salad and stuff. So it's like a legendary thing. Like certain people in the community know, like there's this, Horace Silver is known as having said that she had like the best baked beans and like potato salad that like he ever had in his life. So it's quite a compliment. But, she's a very, very special person and, someone that I think about. And also, when I do a lot of the work for my father, a lot of that is in dedication to my grandparents, you know. My grandfather and my grandmother both migrated to Newark, New Jersey when my father was about 1 year old.
Okay. Where was he born? Your father?
He was born in Laurinburg, North Carolina, which is in Scotland County. And that's where my grandfather's from, grandfather's family. My grandmother is from Truro, South Carolina, which is where Dizzy Gillespie's from.
Oh, okay.
Dizzy and my grandfather went to the same middle school, to the same secondary boarding school, which is Laurinburg Institute.
Oh.
Yeah. As well as other people went. Many other people, famed basketball player Sam Jones, I think Hall of Famer, and Gracian Moncourt III, he went there as well. He's from North Carolina, too.
Wow. I thought he was from New Jersey.
He is. He's from Newark.
Oh.
They're both from Laurinburg and Newark.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So they came up when he was about 1 year old, and my grandfather actually was, he had been a singer. He was, he sang in the quartets. I mean, you could call it gospel music. It's not actually what you would consider to be gospel music today. It was more like spirituals, you know.
Did he record?
To my knowledge, I'm not sure if they recorded or not, but they used to sing on the same circuit as the Fisk Jubilee Singers.
Oh, okay.
So they were like in that, you know, scene. But, you know, from things that I've read and having spoken to my grandmother, it was a very, very influential thing on my father and just the whole family, I guess.
How so?
You know, I don't know. I guess just, you know, certain families have a musical, you know, vibe to them.
It's okay.
Like you have the musical talent in the family and it resonates. Somehow my father was the only one to pursue music professionally. I'm sure that there's other musical talent in the family, but it's just part of the Shaw family history and legacy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she talks about that.
I thought I would wait until after Goody Shaw's solo to let you know what you're listening to right now is Cassandra Knight. It's by Goody Shaw. This is from a reissue of 1989 Muse Records reissue. It was originally recorded in 1965. We have Goody Shaw on trumpet, Joe Henderson on tenor saxophone, Larry Young on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Joe Chambers on drums. Before that, we heard United, the title cut, from a 1981 Columbia Records release, Goody Shaw. Goody Shaw on coronet, the flugelhorn, Steve Turay on trombone, Mulgrew Miller on piano, Stafford James on bass, Tony Reedus on drums and Gary Bartz on some recordings on alto sax. Before that, we heard Stepping Stone by Woody Shaw. That's a Stepping Stone live at the Village Vanguard, 1977 Columbia Records release. And by the way, for the most part, what I'm playing this evening are Woody Shaw compositions. There are only, like, probably two that aren't, and you'll be able to tell which ones they are. The lineup for the Stepping Stone recording is Woody Shaw, cornet, flugelhorn, Carter Jefferson on tenor and soprano saxophone, Onaji Alan Gums on piano, Clint Houston on bass, and Victor Lewis on drums. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl with me, Joyce Jones, and my guest, Woody Shaw III, son of Woody Shaw Jr., who is the son of Woody Shaw Sr. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Why did your father choose the trumpet? How did he wind up playing the trumpet?
Well, that's a great question. My father passed when I was very young. Mm-hmm. So as I speak, a lot of the information that I have is from people that knew him or from things that I know. I mean, you know, facts that I know to be true about his life, mm-hmm. and research that I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So, but as far as his reasons for pursuing music and pursuing the trumpet, he just attributes... Well, from what I understand, initially, he wanted to play saxophone and violin. He was like, he didn't want to play the trumpet at first, but the trumpet was the only instrument that was left.
In school?
In school,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It was one of the early middle schools in Newark, New Jersey.
Okay.
He picked it up, and in a week, he could play it. So he had some kind of natural feeling for the instrument. And I actually did an interview with his teacher, late teacher, mm-hmm. Jerome Ziering. And he told me he was a prodigy, so it was a very natural thing for him to trumpet. But, you know, of course, you know, people like Clifford Brown and Dizzy Gillespie and Louis Armstrong, I think, had a lot to do with his love for the trumpet, you know.
How did he wind up playing with Eric Dolphy? Was that the first person he played with? I mean, in the music?
That's the first person he recorded with.
Okay.
And I think that was the first major, like, mentor kind of figure for him in music.
Okay.
And, but... before that, because Newark has such a rich legacy of music, I think he had already been sitting in with a lot of people like Hank Mobley and Kenny Dorham, people that worked on that circuit, you know, in Newark and places like Philadelphia, New Jersey. And so he started very young, you know, at about 14 years old. So he was, you know, already playing, like working, making money as a kid, you know.
Wow.
But Eric Dolphy apparently heard him playing with Willie Bobo.
Oh.
Yeah. And okay. I think 1962 or something like that. And he was playing with Chick Corea and Joe Farrell were in the band, a lot of people. I think Larry Gills. And Eric, you know, came up to him apparently after the gig and said, "Hey, man, you know, you sound good. You know, I want you to come rehearse with me." And so he ended up recording on one of Eric's great albums, Iron Man.
Yeah.
There's actually an interesting history around that, because my father was supposed to go to Paris to live and play with Eric.
Mm.
Eric had moved to Paris at that point, like a lot of musicians. Charles Mingus moved, and a lot of guys, Bud Powell, Kenny Clarke, were living in Paris. And a lot of the musicians, I think, during that time, who were more revolutionary or adventurous, had decided they were better received abroad. So my father was a young man in that time, so Eric moved to Paris, and the plan was that my father was going to go and join a new band that he was creating with tenor saxophonist Nathan Davis, who was Eric's, like, man at that time, you know, kind of like, he helped organize his bands and stuff.
Music director.
But Eric passed away before my father even got a chance to get it together, so, but they invited him anyway, and they ended up living in Eric's apartment and playing all, you know, his music.
Wow.
And so, like, you know, his influence was very, I think, profound for my father, you know, being 17 or 18 years old at that time, and looking up to people like John Coltrane and Eric Dolphy and trying to understand what they were doing and apply it conceptually to the trumpet, you know. So he more or less, I think, kind of picked up the torch and carried on part of Eric's legacy, you know.
Yeah.
But he was in Paris for a year and a half. He played with Bud Powell and a lot of people. Like.
Thank you.
Your father wind up at Blue Note?
I think a lot of musicians at that time who, you know, had good musicianship and who were on the scene, my father was playing with people like Jackie McLean and Andrew Hill, McCoy Tyner, Herbie mm-hmm. Hancock, Joanna Sen. So he was in that scene. But for a while in the 60s, my father, was, I think, somewhat under the shadow of Freddie Hubbard.
Mm.
You know, not shadow in a negative way, but mm-hmm. Freddie was his idol when he was a young man.
Oh, okay.
You know, but he was so influenced by him, and Freddie was such a prominent figure in the jazz world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the trumpet, I think it was kind of like there was, you know, Freddie. There was a lot of people. I mean, Charles Tolliver and,
mm-hmm.
but Woody and Freddie had a particularly special relationship, and Freddie had kind of taken him under his wing, if I can put it that way, even
okay.
though my father was his own man in the sense that he recommended him for Horace Silver's band.
Okay.
So when my father was in Paris, he got a letter from my grandfather saying Horace Silver was looking for him.
Wow.
But he had been recommended by Joe Henderson and Freddie Hubbard.
Okay.
So that, you know, they knew of him and knew that he could fit the bill, you know. So that was his first, I think that was his first Blue Note album, was Cape Verdean Blues with
okay.
Horace Silver. Just one of my favorite albums, you know. And then from there, you know, he was a very, very good musician from a young age. You know, he had problems with his eyes. He had retinitis pigmentosa, so which is like poor vision at night and challenges with peripheral vision. So I think he had to rely on a lot of his mental faculties, and resulted in him being a reliable musician because he could read very well and he had a photographic memory.
Wow.
My father, so. Thank you.
what you're listening to right now is Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers. That's right. This is Love for the One You Can't. Love for the One You Can't. Written by Woody Shaw when he was a jazz messenger. This is from, the spelling is odd, but it actually means, and then again, and then again. It's a 1973 release on Prestige Records. It's Art Blakey on drums, Woody Shaw on trumpet, Mickey Bass on bass, Tony Waters on congas, Cedar Walton on electric piano on this particular cut, regular piano on others, Carter Jefferson on tenor saxophone, and Steve Turay yet again on trombone. And before that we heard the Cape Verdean Blues, Horace Silver. It was written by Horace Silver. The title cut on the 1965 Blue Note release. Woody Shaw on trumpet, Joe Henderson on tenor saxophone, Larry Young on piano. Wait a minute. Is that for real? Wait a minute. Let me check something here. Okay. Well, that was just cockeyed. What actually happened here was Woody Shaw on trumpet, J.J. Johnson on not on that one, Joe Henderson on tenor sax, Horace Silver on piano, Bob Cranshaw on bass, and Roger Humphreys on drums. That's on the Cape Verdean Blues, Blue Note 1965. Before that, we heard Iron Man, the title cut. That's a 1969 Douglas Records release. Eric Dolphy on reed instruments. Woody Shaw on trumpet. I'm talking over right now. It's just blasphemous. Eddie Kahn on bass. J.C. Moses on drums. Prince Lasha on flute. And Bobby Hutcherson on vibes. And stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl. Coming up next, more Sugar in My Bowl. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sunday, November 6th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature the innovative jazz trumpeter, cornetist, flugelhornist, composer, and band leader, Woody Shaw,
will talk to Woody's son, Woody Shaw III, and sample the box set, Woody Shaw, the Complete Columbia Albums Collection. That's Sunday, November 6th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
So how did your father wind up being a jazz messenger?
Well, that's also interesting. How he wound up in that situation, I'm not quite sure how he initially met Art Blakey, but I believe that my father was one of the first people to audition for the band after Freddie Hubbard left the band.
Okay.
Well, I'm talking like the time that Wayne Shorter went to Miles' band.
Okay.
When the band, you know, he started having more interim musicians and stuff and wasn't really a set messengers. So in the late 60s, more or less, my father and Art became really close. And there's some great early recordings, kind of bootleg recordings that are really great, of them playing together.
Bootleg?
No, but they're available now. You know, they're available on the internet and stuff.
Oh, what is it? For instance?
Well, there's one at Newport Jazz Festival, and there's another one at Rutgers University.
Okay.
And I think it's George Cables, Carlos Garnett. But, you know, they started to work together. There's actually an interesting story about that I heard recently, word of mouth from some reliable sources, about that time when my father was playing with Art Blakey. He was actually playing with Max Roach at the same time.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
Oh.
George Cables and Gary Bartz were apparently working with Art Blakey and Max Roach at the same time. And there's this funny story about them being double booked and everything, which I don't want to go and talk about, you know. But my father's, his main guy was Art Blakey. That was his, I think he looked up to him like a father in terms of that integrity, you know, about jazz and the future. And, oh, as a matter of fact, I was talking to Wallace Roney recently, because Wallace Roney was also very, very close with my father, too.
Okay. Another trumpeter.
Another great trumpet player. Mm-hmm. But they had a special relationship, more or less. He refers to my father as his uncle. He said, no, Miles was my dad. Woody was like my uncle. You know?
Oh, okay.
But he made a clarification for me about, and which relates somewhat to these box sets, about how Art Blakey was so prominent and played such a part in keeping jazz alive, because when the word would get out that he was having an audition, a lot of musicians would come from all over the world to audition for his band.
Wow.
Young musicians, whether they could play or not.
Oh, my goodness.
Which he said was always good for the music because it was, they were inspired and it was, you know, they were practicing and auditioning and stuff.
Wow.
And Art Blakey, in times when I guess it was, you know, hard to get work, you know, in the late 60s, early 70s, he just kept working as much as he could. And my father was really under his wing at that point. It was, they lived together at one point.
Yeah. Really?
Art and Woody, yeah.
Okay.
Over on, I think, 45th and 8th. They had a very close family-like relationship. So Art, I think there was a lot of overlapping history and different factors, but one of them was also, I think, the death of Lee Morgan, because as such, in the way that it's been told to me by the elders, that Lee was such a central figure in the jazz messenger community, so to speak, that his departure was really a heavy blow to just like, oh, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
You know, and Art was kind of like the general. Like, he had to figure out how to keep the bands together and how to get the best new musicians. And so it was very special history, and I think my father had already been told, as I've been read it, that, you know, he was the next cat, more or less, like, you know, you got it, you know. So that was like a responsibility that he really, he went all the way with that, you know.
Well, I'm trying to remember who told me the relationship of being a jazz messenger, you know, with Art Blakey, because of his passion of being a messenger of jazz, that being his calling, that everyone who came through then became a jazz messenger.
Right.
You know,
right.
Everybody who came through.
Yeah, I think that there's something that is left out of history books and box sets, not these, but often, with people who just don't know. I mean, these people write about things that they have, you know, 6th, 7th degree relationships with the source. You know, they haven't lived close enough to the environment to be able to talk with such authority about the events that took place or how the things impacted people's lives, you know. And I'm not, again, a lot of the things that you're asking me about, I wasn't even born, right? But I have spent enough time in the environment, I think, at this point now to be able to speak, you know, pretty comfortably about what is real and what is not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as the R. Blakey situation, I think that people just don't understand how dedicated and how, man, it's just... It's a level of integrity there that is very uncommon, you know, amongst, I would say, most human beings, you know, but especially musicians challenged or faced with economic challenges in a dwindling economy, whether it was then or now. I think a lot of musicians, they kind of, you know, they have to make certain decisions. Obviously, everyone does, but I think R. Blakey was one of those people that it didn't matter what was happening in the environment. It didn't matter what was happening economically. It didn't matter what was happening. It could be wartime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to remember, like, he came up in wartime. Like, he was playing in Billy Eckstine's band during, you know, pretty much during World War II.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those guys, Charlie Parker, mm-hmm. Miles, Dexter, you know, Festival, Sal Vaughan. Like, so hard times is not like, I mean, that doesn't change the level of your dedication and commitment.
Mm-hmm.
To your art. If anything, I think it heightens your responsibility. And for them, I think that was more or less the attitude. But my father really, I think he was really influenced by that mentality that it doesn't matter what's happening. Like, this is your obligation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's an honor, you know, okay. to be able to do this, you know.
It was actually Jimmy Merritt who shared that information about Art Blakey and playing with him,
wow.
you know, after he left. He was a jazz messenger. You know, everybody was a jazz messenger. He was one as well. You know, so
that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish more people could say that. I mean, I, you know, I'm like, wasn't born, but I consider myself to be a jazz messenger.
Oh, I think you are as well.
You know, it's like, thank you. I appreciate that. And my family, too. You know, even my mother, she's not a musician, but there's a certain understanding and a certain relationship.
Mm.
That certain people have with the music, where they know, they understand the life and the culture behind the music,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they understand that it's such an honor that it's something you have to take very seriously to be part of the legacy of jazz, you know.
So who is Maxine Gregg?
Maxine Gregg. Well, we don't actually refer to Maxine Gregg as Maxine Gregg. Maxine Gregg is Maxine Gordon now.
Okay. Who is Maxine Gordon?
Maxine Gordon is my mother. And the manager, producer of Dexter Gordon, and widow of Dexter Gordon. And prior to that was the manager and producer of my father, Big Show.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. Sure. I run into Maxine all the time. I didn't know about that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I want to go back to discuss the recordings that your father did with Freddie Hubbard.
Okay.
Have you heard any discussion around that exchange?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Tell me something.
I'm glad you asked about that. I just did an interview with Michael Cuscuna about these sets, and he actually went into some detail about those sessions because he produced them.
I mean, it looks as though they had fun, so...
Well, the way that I've been told, and from the way that I understand it, is obviously there was a very special relationship between Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw. Freddie Hubbard, as we know, is one of the greatest trumpet players ever walked planet Earth, period, right? And my father...
Actually, he's one of the greatest sax players on the trumpet.
Wow. I would have to say, I think him and Woody, in terms of that,
right,
they had it, you know,
right,
could have duped it out a little bit. Freddie, you know, and my father, as I said before, had a special relationship. My father, early on in his development, that was one of his references, you know, Freddie. And my father took it to another place, musically, harmonically. He took the trumpet to his own place. But there was a mutual respect there and a loving rivalry, mm-hmm, between them that was somewhat known in the jazz community.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the 70s and 80s, for the trumpet, the 70s, because Freddie Hubbard did a lot of other types of music too, you know.
He was doing the CTI stuff.
He was doing that. And my father was, you know, kind of got on him about that because,
yeah,
he wanted him to, you know, be more straight ahead. Mm-hmm. So my father was like championing the straight ahead legacy and trying to extend that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of an extension of the John Coltrane ethos, if you will, about music and, mm-hmm, very worldly view about music, and really wanted to develop it. So he was a little frustrated with Freddie, you know, musical decisions that he made, but he had such a deep admiration and respect for him on the trumpet. And eventually I think that became a mutual respect, because I think that Freddie, I mean, to be that great on the trumpet, I mean, and have, in that time, so few peers for him,
mm-hmm,
you know, so I think that it was like, wow, okay, you know, there I have my brother, like, you know, thank you, you know, it's like it. So I know that when my father died, you know, my mother was telling me that she ran into Freddie and he said, Max, you know, man, you know, Woody, there's nobody out here for me, you know, it's like, because he needed that push. So they had that type of competitive relationship that kept them at their highest level, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that album was an attempt to document some of that, although it was later and they were older.
Which album? Because there are
three albums, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were renamed, but it came out It was reissued as double tape for Blue Note, but initially there was one, Eternal Triangle. Mm-hmm. There's a third one, a more obscure one that a lot of people don't know about, called Time Speaks, with Benny Golson, which is great. Benny Golson and Ben Reilly, I can't remember who was on piano and bass, but that's a really nice one too. Benny Golson adds in a whole another element to it. Did I say whole another?
Yes, you did.
That's not even
it's staying
word.
Too.
So it came out double take, and the way that Michael Koskuna expressed it to me was that he really wanted to capture that. They had a, you know, it was like the sparring session they would have, but they really loved each other, you know, because to be able to do what the two of them did and do it, they were interconnected, but it was so different how they approached the instrument. It was something remarkable, and actually Michael has some funny stories about that session.
We like stories.
Well, apparently... Because Michael and Woody had a personal relationship as well. They were good friends. So when they started those sessions, one story has it that Freddie came into the, you know, like this, like into the studio area, and he closed the door and he brought a chair over to Michael and he sat down and he said, "Now listen, I know you and Woody are tight. I don't want Woody sounding better than me on this record." And Michael's like, "Okay, Freddie, you know." But I don't know if he was joking or not, but it's just indicative of how their minds worked, and, you know. And it's so interesting that they could be that competitive and have so much love. And I mean, we like to over-romanticize the arts and act like, you know, these guys are not, you know, trying to be the best in the world or be the best that they can. But trumpet players especially, we know, are noted for their... confidence.
Yes.
We'll call it that. And then there was another event. You know, somebody, Kenny Garrett, and somebody else told me. A couple people told me about it. That my father was soloing, and he really started to get into his thing. Mm-hmm. And my father, when he got into his thing on the trumpet, was one of those things where, like, you know, your hair kind of starts standing up. You know, that he was a really passionate, virtuosic musician. So when he got into his thing, it was like a bit scary, I think. But apparently, you know, he started to get into his thing, and Freddie was like, cut, no, I'm not having that. I don't want you signing better than me on this.
Oh my gosh.
So you would never suspect that, you know, but it's kind of cute, you know.
Uh-huh.
It's like, wow, it's like these are grown men,
yeah.
But they're like, you know, but it's nice, man. And that's a great record. I hope that they reissue it.
So what's your relationship like with Dwayne, Freddie's son?
Oh, Dwayne and I? Well, Dwayne more or less became acquainted on the internet.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, the internet does that.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, wow, okay. You know, it's just kind of odd. It's like a virtual introduction, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's more or less doing what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Which is, I think that he started a little bit more recently.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I know what he's trying to do. And, you know, what we do is not easy.
Right.
It's a labor of love. And it's an ongoing process, too. It's a learning process. Not like there's a precedent for this type of position. Mm-hmm. It's like so many roles that you have to play. It's a business responsibility as well. Mm-hmm. The publishing, the legal aspects of the business. Well, in my particular case, you know, also being a musician, being an artist.
Are you now? What do you play?
I'm a drummer.
Are you really?
Yes, I am.
Have you recorded?
I have not recorded.
Okay. Do you play around town?
At the moment, I'm not.
Oh. When was the last time you played? Around town.
It's been a little while. I'm back in school right now.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Columbia University Graduate School of Arts Management and Administration. So that's one of the things I'm trying to do is just be a little bit more organized.
Yeah.
Consolidate many of the activities and responsibilities I have into one framework, you know, which includes Dexter's work.
Right. Could you expand on their relationship your father had between martial arts and the discipline that it...
Oh, that's... I'm glad you asked that, because that's... I think that's a very unique aspect of his life and something that is worthy of further exploration. Well, you know, it's an art. Martial arts is a practice of personal, physical, mental, spiritual development. Music can be looked at similarly. And martial arts requires a lot of discipline and dedication. Jazz is the same way, or was the same way at a certain point. But I think that in his particular case, you know, the need to stay sharp and have your mental faculties and your reflexes and to kind of have to remain in a state of alignment. You know, it's like it's a big responsibility. Requires a lot of discipline. It's like you hear someone like Bruce Lee talk about honestly express yourself. That is really, you know, mm-hmm. It's easy to be like, you know, cocky and all that, but to like really be true to your nature and to your intentions and then have the equipment, the technique to do that, to execute that and have the conviction behind it, is that's an art in and of itself. When you're not as, and this is one of the reasons why I put those characters on the, when you are more intellectual and more from the ego or more from memory, I think it's a lot easier to pretend about what you're doing in the presentation. It's more than notes, but, you know, it's not just the notes. It's the life, you know, the notes represent life, you know. So it's kind of like, I think for jazz musicians, when they enter a state of improvisation, for very serious musicians, it's like you're out on the edge, mm-hmm. the limb. I mean, it looks like you're up there on stage having fun, but in the experience is as if you don't know what's going to happen, you know, mm-hmm. really. I mean, I think that you have a certain level of preparation, but you try to get to that place of total spontaneity. And to be in that position requires preparation and mastery, mm-hmm. self-mastery. You have to be, at that point, it has to be a reflex. Because if you're thinking about it, then you're not in the moment, right?
Right, right.
So that preparation requires years of discipline and dedication. And that dedication has to be rooted in your soul, in your heart, not just in your body. It's not just a technical thing. So I think that set my father apart, or still sets him apart as an artist, in that everything he did on the horn, technically, harmonically, mm-hmm. so to speak, you know, a lot of the academics and things like to isolate, they'll take a transcription and they're like, dissected, but it has absolutely no context or reference to his life, mm-hmm. you know, or to his experience as a man or, you know, as an African American in this country. There's so many different layers to what the music symbolizes. Mm-hmm. And I think for artists of his generation, they were very aware of every note, every nuance in the music and how that was a reflection of their life experience. So to be in a position to express that and have it come across, I think is a big, big responsibility. You have to be true to yourself. You have to be confident in yourself, and you have to be prepared technically and otherwise. Technically, not just in terms of the physicality of playing an instrument, but in terms of your intellect and making the proper decisions in the music, you know, as an improviser. So that there are a lot of parallels between improvised music and martial arts, because ultimately it's about being in the moment, being free, mm-hmm. you know, but to get there requires hard work, you know, which, like, the word kung fu literally means hard work. Mm.
That discipline, how did it affect your upbringing?
That's thank you for asking that. That's an interesting question. I've never been asked that before, but definitely when I was a child, my father, I witnessed him doing, he used to do Tai Chi Chuan a lot, Wu style Tai Chi, which to the average person, it looks like a slowed down version of karate or kung fu, right? But it's more or less a form of meditation where you, the object is to be as relaxed as possible, to be fully in control by not exerting control. It's like allowing your body to move and maintaining proper alignment of your body. It's a very healthy practice. It's good for your respiratory system and your skeletal structure and all of that. So, you know, I used to see my father doing this, like, as a kid, and be like, what? Like, you know, wow, just this man in the zone, like, making these slow movements. And as my grandmother told me, you know, he'd, like, take me out in the backyard, and he'd be like, wait, Lewis, you know, follow me. Mm. You know, and, like, make me follow his moves and stuff. And I also saw him doing yoga, which was this practice that I think he and Larry Young used to do together, which is called Shirsha Asana, which is it's a headstand motion. It's like you stand on your head and your legs kind of move around. Mm. Yeah. And it enhances circulation to the brain. Mm-hmm. And one of the benefits is supposed to be memory, you know, enhanced memory. And I told you my father was noted for having like a photographic memory.
Right.
So these things, these types of things, I was raised around since very, very young. If you see on the cover of United, for example, he and I both are wearing like a kind of a martial arts outfit.
Right.
And on the back of Master of the Art, he's doing like some kind of Qigong or Tai Chi movement. He's looking and I'm there like looking off in the corner somewhere, like totally distracted. But
so how did it affect you?
I would have to say that just through osmosis, I think when you're a child, you know, your frame of reference is everything that is in your environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything you see, everything you hear. You know, I was 3 weeks old in the Village Vanguard, you know, basket. You know, like that is the environment I was born up in. It's around artists. So when you see the adults in a state of kind of inner exploration, in a state of meditation, you see something. It exposes you to another state, another way to be. And I don't think register until I was an older, young adult when I started traveling. I went to places like India and Vietnam, and I got involved in, you know, some Tai Chi and things of that nature and started studying things. But it was something that was such a part of my natural environment that I didn't really start to realize how much it had impacted my outlook until years later, you know. I don't think it was uncommon for a lot of musicians. A lot of guys did interesting things, you know, as artists, explored different cultures and things like that.
Right.
I mean, that's another part of it, too. When I was a kid, I went wherever my parents went. You know, when they went on the road, I was always there.
Mm-hmm.
So more or less, I grew up on the road, traveling, you know. It's like to be in one place for too long is like really kind of strange, you know. So I've always kind of felt like a world citizen, you know.
Was your father awarded a jazz master?
He never was.
Didn't think so.
He never was. Yeah. My father, you know, that you mentioned that, and I don't want to sound like, you know, man, you know, my father, you know, he should have gotten this and gotten that. But he passed away when he was 44 years old, which I'm 33 now, so... Wow, 44, he didn't accomplish that much. But I think that his music was very much ahead of its time. You know, a lot of people now speak to me and they're like, he really pushed the boundaries, not only of the instrument, but of music.
Mm-hmm.
I was speaking to Eddie Allen the other day, trumpeter.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he was explaining to me is that, you know, he changed the environment, the musical environment, so it forced musicians to think differently about music.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that takes time. That takes generations. Classical music, they didn't really realize what Bach and these people had done until, like, in some cases, hundreds of years later.
That would be European classical, because some people refer to jazz as American classical.
Right. I think that, aside from the fact that he was in some ways ahead of his time, I think that he also wasn't seeking accolades in the material sense. The reward for him was being able to work and being able to perform and work on his music comfortably, without disruption and a lot of the distractions that come along with being in the business. I'm not sure he was too keen on being your typical band leader. You know, I think it's something he excelled at because of his discipline and his dedication to music, but the business side of it, I think, was kind of a drag to him, you know, especially in that time. And the pressure, I think I've been told that was something that it weighed somewhat heavily on him, the responsibility of being one of the few who part of their forward vision was to play straight ahead jazz. A lot of guys were like, well, okay, I did that already.
Mm-hmm.
My father was like, I'm going to keep doing this. I want to develop this, you know. well into the future. I think if it was up to him, he'd still be around playing different interpretations of the tradition, you know, and try to develop it. Not that, you know, it wasn't developing, it hasn't developed since then, but he had his own visions, and it wasn't one of compromise, you know, and it wasn't one of changing your direction for the sake of monetary gain or fame. That just wasn't part of his character nor his philosophy, you know. So jazz masters and things like that, it's kind of, yeah, in some ways it would have, I think, been nice to him to have been acknowledged. Mm-hmm. More, but then when I think about it a little bit deeper, it's kind of like he's in his own
category.
Yeah,
his own,
you know, yeah. as an artist thinker, mm-hmm. kind of, he has his own world that right. he, and you know, people who relate to that and understand it, they understand totally what that's about. And it's about art. It's about the work itself, not all the stuff outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
I respect that about him and his legacy, you know, whatever sacrifices may have come about as a result.
At this point, the jazz master is sort of questionable anyway when it could be given to an entire family. But that's my feeling.
Whoa, yeah. You said a lot there. That might be another conversation, actually.
Yeah.
Or another show altogether.
Every time I think about the jazz masters and, you know, the fact that, you know, it was given to an entire family, and then there's talk of discontinuing the jazz masters.
Right, so, a year later.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. And that family got the Jazz Masters after the award ceremony was brought to Lincoln Center. So it was like the year after it was brought to Lincoln Center, that family got.
Oh, it was only a year after.
It was only a year after.
I went to that one, actually, the family one. I mean, somebody invited me or something.
Oh, okay. Actually, wish I had been at the one where Bobby Hutcherson got his.
That was nice.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
And I saw some nice videos anyway.
Yeah.
And Bobby Hutcherson was a guest. So.
Bobby is another beautiful artist
yes.
and human being.
Yes.
And like one of my father's closest friends.
Mm.
And collaborators.
As a matter of fact, Rosewood.
I mean, the original. You know
yes.
about the original. You know, I think...
is there more to know about Rosewood?
Well, one interesting thing is he wrote it with the title. The title was named for the marimba. You know that?
No, actually.
Okay, now you do.
Yeah.
And somebody, I think it was Bobby or Bobby's wife, Rosemary, said to Woody, hey, Rosewood, isn't that your parents' name? And like, oh, so he changed it. He claimed it, but, you know, they had a really, really close relationship. And they played together with Eric Dolphy,
mm-hmm.
you know, together, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
So they go way back. Great, great artists, man.
All right.
You don't?
No, actually. One other something.
No,
I understand your father influenced two trumpeters. I'm sure he influenced many more, but current trumpeters, Terrence Blanchard and Sean Jones.
Well, yeah, I would say influenced, to say the least. Sean Jones, I think, is a little bit more direct musically. Mm-hmm. Sean Jones cites Miles Clifford Brown, Freddie Hubbard, and my father as mm-hmm. some of his main influences.
Okay.
And you can kind of hear it more in a direct way. You know, when you hear musicians, younger musicians,
mm-hmm.
you can hear who they really listen to, you know. With Terrence, I think when he came to New York and when he was coming up and around the time he was playing with Art Blakey, that was a period where my father and Art were kind of recruiting in a way. Like mm-hmm. they were helping a lot of and encouraging a lot of the young musicians and on the scene. So in the early 80s in particular, my father and Art Blakey were, my father's band and Art Blakey's band were two of the core bands on the scene and in New York that were responsible for, you know, kind of pushing younger musicians out there. My father let a lot of people sit in with him, like people like a lot of people, you know, Wallace, Winton, before Winton was really well known, actually took a National Endowment of the Arts grant to study with my father. Very few people know that.
What?
Correct.
Wow.
And Winton used to sit in with my father. The first time Bruce Lumbaugh heard Winton was sitting in with my father, and that's when he got signed to Columbia.
Wow.
So my father was a major catalyst for Wynton Marsalis's exposure in the early 80s, as was Art Blakey, you know. Mm-hmm. But my father would recommend people like he recommended Wallace to Art,
mm-hmm.
at which he probably would already got the gig. But they had that kind of recruiting role on the scene and relationship, and it was like, I think, kind of like gatekeepers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so,
well, they were jazz messengers.
They were jazz messengers,
mm-hmm.
thank you. They
right.
were the jazz, at that time. And not only that, but they were the jazz messengers that were straight, you know, straight ahead. Like,
mm-hmm.
that was it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like they were jazz messengers and then went and made like a disco record. You know.
Right, right.
It was like that. So, a lot of musicians, actually Chris Botti, you know, took also, as far as I understand, also received an NEA grant to study with my father. I spent some time with him. You would
wow.
never suspect Chris Botti. Yeah.
No.
Chris Botti went to Indiana University and studied with David Baker.
Hmm. And who's David Baker?
He can play. I mean, David Baker is the chairman of jazz studies at Indiana University in Bloomington. It's actually the Jacobs School of Music. He's also, I believe, the director of the Smithsonian Jazz Orchestra.
Hmm.
And he's a prominent jazz educator, one of the earliest really leading jazz educators. Chris
Botti
had,
yeah.
you know, spent some time with my father. So there's quite a few people that came on the scene in the 80s that used to hang out. Another person is Ingrid Munson, who is the Quincy Jones Professor of African American Music at Harvard University.
Oh, okay.
She studied with my father, too.
Wow.
Study, I don't know what that means. But she received a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts to study with Woody Shaw, you know.
Oh, this is rather interesting that people are receiving grants to study with your father.
Well, that's always been an issue.
What
know?
Was that all about? How did, what does your father get?
Well, he probably got some of the money, you know.
Okay.
But,
but I mean, what does...
Yeah, I mean, that's just this whole thing, you know. I mean, it's always been an issue that, you know, I mean, how do we reward and honor our elders, not so mm-hmm. much in the sense that they have to be old,
mm-hmm.
but the people who laid the foundation mm-hmm. and did all the hard work and paid the dues for you to be able to even have an art form to learn in the first place. I just think that, you know, as a culture and as a country as a whole, we're very behind in terms of a collective ability to recognize the value of the arts and culture in enhancing our quality of life. And if you go to many other societies around the world, although they may have social or economic problems, they revere the, you know, their ancestors, their cultural heritage. They have a respect for their elders, a respect for the traditions that have been laid down as a result of generations of hard work. And that's wisdom. We don't have that. Definitely not on an institutional level. You know, we may have that as individuals, but... So we let our artists suffer, and then when they're gone, we, you know, we exploit the result of their labor, and we take credit for their hard work, you know.
Well, fortunately.
I mean, not to sound too, like, well, grim about it, but, you know, I think that some would agree there's some truth to that. You know,
definitely, you know. Definitely. And fortunately, that's not something that's going to happen to the legacy of Woody Shaw and Dexter Gordon.
Not as long as I'm alive, no.
Thank you so much, Woody Shaw the Third.
Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
We'd like to continue with a Woody Shaw composition, in case you haven't heard.
To talk over Dexter Gordon, but at some point we do have to get out of here, and I thought I'd let you know what you've been listening to. By the way, if you miss something, you can email me at sugainmybowl@gmail.com, sugainmybowl@gmail.com. If you'd also like a playlist before it actually goes up, or, well, it should be going up on sugainmybowl.org really soon, because I'm going to send it to my web assistant, Hank Williams, and he'll have it up when, you know, in between the other billion things that he has on his plate to do. But just so you know, what you're listening to right now is, it's from the Dexter Gordon, the Complete Columbia Albums Collection. This is sort of like a preview of the next Sugar in My Bowl, which is going to be on Sunday, November 20th. I'll be talking to Woody Shaw Jr. again, and his mother, Maxine Gordon. So that's something to look forward to as we talk about Dexter Gordon. But this is from Homecoming, as mentioned in the introduction by Dexter Gordon. This is In Case You Haven't Heard. It was written by Woody Shaw. And, yes, it's from Homecoming, live at the Village Vanguard, a 1977 Columbia Records release. Dexter Gordon on tenor sax, Woody Shaw on trumpet, Ronnie Matthews on piano, Stafford James on bass, and Lewis Hayes on drums. Before that, we heard Rosewood, the Woody Shaw version, on the 1977 Columbia Records release, which is the title cut, actually, Rosewood. Woody Shaw on trumpet, cornet, flugelhorn. Carter Jefferson on tenor and soprano saxophones. Joe Henderson on tenor sax. Steve Turay on trombone. Clint Houston on bass and Victor Lewis on drums. Before that, we heard the Bobby Hutcherson version from Cirrus, C-I-R-R-U-S, Cirrus, the 1974 Blue Note release. Bobby Hutcherson on vibraphone, Woody Shaw on trumpet, Harold Land, Manny Boyd on tenor saxophone and flute, Bill Henderson on piano and electric piano on others, Ray Drummond on bass, Larry Hancock on drums, and Kenneth Nash on percussion. Before that, we heard Moon Train, The Moon Train. That was Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw from The Eternal Triangle. It's a 1988 Blue Note release. Freddie Hubbard on trumpet in the left channel. Woody Shaw on trumpet in the right channel. Kenny Garrett on tenor saxophone. Mulgrew Miller on piano. Ray Drummond on bass. And Carl Allen on drums. Before that, we heard Theme for Maxine from Benny Golson. Time Speaks. Yes, I found it. Time Speaks. It's a Timeless Records 1985 release. Freddie Hubbard and Woody Shaw on trumpets. Benny Golson on tenor saxophone. Kenny Barron on piano and Cecil McBee on bass. Ben Riley on drums. And, yeah, so on the 20th, yeah, let's listen to some more of this. On the 20th of November, I'll be back with Woody Shaw III and Maxine Gordon, his mummy. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl. A little more music before we hear La Nueva from La Nueva Alternativa coming up next. Stay tuned.
sky is clear. We cried all our tears, and we saved all our smiles for this moment.
Interrupt this one. I'll have to listen to the rest of it when I get home. That's it for me. This is Joyce Jones. And that is it for Sugar My Bowl this evening. What you're listening to right now is Ginseng People from For Sure, Woody Shaw, 1970. Oh, goodness. See, I'm supposed to be ready and I'm not. 19. I can't see. Email me at sugar, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. Sugar, in my bowl, S-U-G-A, in my bowl, at gmail.com. And I will send you a playlist, or you can go to our website, whichever happens first, sugarinmybowl.org. What you heard before that was In Case You Haven't Heard, as mentioned. And we need to get ready to get out of here. Get ready for La Nueva Alternativa. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. If you get a chance, pick up the Complete Columbia Records recordings. They're really beautiful box sets. I wasn't kidding. You know, if you look on the WBAI website, if you were able to, you would have seen the cover. But next up, La Nueva Alternativa. And I'll be back on the 20th of November. Stay tuned.
We waited so long to sing you this song, and we saved all our smiles for this moment. It's not so hard to understand what is in the heart of a man. All he wishes,
Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.